Thank you. Wow, we almost made it. Thank you all for sticking it out, and thank you, Molly, for this incredible opportunity to be the last speaker and to come at all, but no. So I feel like this is a really good cap of this conference because it is very extreme. We are actually not going to explicitly talk about genetics at all. We're going to talk about a cool evolutionary story that I think gives us some insights into constraints that genetics can have on evolution, and the story hopefully will motivate further evolutionary and genetic investigations. So to be more explicit, we are going to talk about mate choice in plants, those green things. And I argue that there are two super important mate choices that plants have to make, or at least that we're going to discuss today. One of them is also made in animals that we've talked a lot about, is whether or not to hybridize, and how to stop hybridizing if you don't want to. The other one that is much more plant specific is whether or not to self-fertilize. So most plants are hermaphroditic and they can actually pollinate themselves and set their own seed. And so in some cases, both hybridizing and self-pollinating can be really good, and you can get hybrid vigor or adaptive introgression. Or if you're self-pollinating, you can get reproductive assurance such that in areas of low mate availability or pollinator availability, you can reproduce without anybody else. But under most circumstances, we think that indeed hybridization is usually bad, where there's selection against having sterile or inviable hybrids that are maladapted to a particular environment, and that self-pollination can be bad because you increase homozygosity of deleterious recessive mutations and get inbreeding depression. And so under most circumstances, plants are trying to avoid hybridization and avoid self-pollination. And in order to do this, they have come up with a number of mechanisms of mate choice. And the most charismatic is to manipulate pollinator movement within and between species through evolving these charismatic traits: flower color, size, shape, smell, nectar. Or, we're not going to talk about that today, or through manipulating developmental timing, both within a flower of sexual organs and between flowers and species, in order to manipulate, again, timing of reproduction and choosing who's available to mate with. We're not going to talk about that. What we're going to talk about, which is what I think is super interesting arena that in which mate choice occurs, is between pollen and pistil. So shown here is the stigmatic surface, the receptive part of a female sexual organ, and pollen bound to it. Let's see if I can not turn off my screen. These are all little pollens. Right, and so there are biochemical interactions between pollen and pistil, which enable the pistil to recognize and accept or reject pollen that it wants or it doesn't want. And in this arena, we get both mate choice in terms of self-recognition and rejection, and heterospecific pollen recognition and rejection. So how and when does this happen? Well, first, the pollen has to actually bind physically to the stigmatic surface in most plants. And this is an active biochemical process sometimes. Germination of the pollen tube has to happen. The pollen tube has to grow through this sometimes highly toxic and scary style environment. And eventually, the sperm has to actually get to the egg. And at any one of these stages, plants have and can evolve mechanisms through which they can recognize and reject pollen. So my question is, do these two seemingly distinct mechanisms of mate choice that have very different outcomes, are they connected evolutionarily, selectively, or mechanistically? And there are two alternative ways in which it has been hypothesized and in some species shown that they can be connected. The first is through an explicit mechanistic interaction, where at the developmental genetic level, they are one in the same, or at least pleiotropic. So this is broadly viewed as the SISC rule. And what this means is that within a genera, there are closely related species, that some are self-incompatible, SI, some are self-compatible, SC. And what has been observed is that these self-incompatible species are also highly incompatible with other species in that genus that are closely related. So then those individual species that are self-compatible are highly compatible, therefore can set hybrid seed with other species in that genus. And this has led to a pattern of correlation across species in a number of different, very distantly related genera, where we see self-incompatibility at this pistil pollen level correlated with interspecific incompatibility at this pollen pistil level. So this has resulted in the strong hypothesis that there's a mechanistic interaction that could possibly constrain or influence the evolution of these traits of compatibility. Alternatively, in other systems, it seems that evolution is influenced by what we can think of as a selective avoidance hypothesis. And that is, if you are self-incompatible, you are entirely dependent on pollinators or outside forces to bring you pollen. And therefore, you are open to heterospecific pollen and production of pollen of hybrids. But if you are self-compatible, you have the option, and sometimes do quite readily, self-pollinate even before outside pollen, outcross pollen, comes to your stigmatic surface or hits your pistil. And in this scenario, you might imagine that self-compatible individuals may actually have lower hybridization than self-incompatible individuals because they simply shut off all outside pollination and therefore stop hybridization. So you have these two alternative hypotheses that you could have greater hybridization with more self-compatible individuals because self-compatibility leads to interspecific compatibility and therefore you get more hybridization. Or you may have more hybridization with self-incompatible individuals because those self-compatible individuals just hole up and don't mate with anybody else, and so there's no chance for hybridization at all. And so what I was interested in is understanding how this might play out on an actual geographic landscape. That is, what do we see in nature in variation in self-compatibility? But there's a few things we have to understand about the system before we can make predictions about what we would actually see in nature in a sympatric region where self-compatibility could evolve. And that is, hybridization has to occur, right? There's got to be something that selection is possible to act on, and that hybridization is costly. And then if that hybridization is costly, we also need to have some variation in self-compatibility. And if all three of these things are true, then we can start to look at whether we get less self-compatibility and sympatry, as might be predicted by a mechanistic interaction, this genetic link between these two incompatibilities. Or we might have increased self-compatibility in sympatry, as has been hypothesized through the selective avoidance mechanism. So I wanted to look at this, and so we're using this flock system where we have two species, Phlox drummondii and Phlox cuspidata. They are very similar phenotypically. They're pollinated by the same pollinators. They grow in Texas, and in green you'll see this large area of sympatry where the two species co-occur. And so the question then is, how is self-compatibility evolving in this region of sympatry? But first, we have to know if they hybridize, if that hybridization is costly, and if there's actually variation in self-compatibility. So real quick, let me tell you yes. If you go to these sympatric populations, Phlox drummondii is the red one, Phlox cuspidata is this purple one, and this is a hybrid in the field. So we can see that there are hybrids. But we might ask, is this hybridization of evolutionary significance? Is this enough to even say matter in long-term evolution? So to look at that, we actually measured the transcriptome, sequenced the transcriptomes of a number of individuals and looked for genomic signatures of introgression across these species. So Phlox cuspidata and Phlox drummondii are the two that we're interested in sympatry here in green. And we took an individual of cuspidata, two individuals of drummondii, one from sympatry and one from allopatry, and then an individual of this other closely related species, Romariana, shown in blue, as well as Pilosa, which is an outgroup to this small Texas clade. So we estimated the phylogeny and then looked for evidence of introgression. And this was done by an awesome postdoc who's in the lab, Federico Rota. So the phylogeny was pretty clear that drummondii and Romariana were sister species. This means that in this region of sympatry between drummondii and cuspidata, they're not actually sister to each other. But that whole group diverged, a small clade diverged less than 2 million years ago. So we have strong support for this phylogeny, but a lot of discordance across gene trees. in this relationship, as you might expect for plants that hybridize all the time and recently diverged lineages. So when we look at gene trees, we see that fewer than 40% of the gene trees show the species tree relationship. So shown here, I'm just looking at this Sympatric sample of Drummondii, where about 40% of the gene trees show Drummondii is sister to Remariana, as is indicated by the species tree. But the rest of the gene trees show these patterns of discordance, where Cuspidata is sister to Drummondii, or Remariana, that other species, is sister to Cuspidata. These are inconsistent with the species tree. And if we look at the allopatric sample, we see similar amounts of overall discordance, although slightly different patterns. And what do I mean by that? So we can use, we have already heard about this ABBA-BABBA test or these D statistics to look at patterns of discordance across the genome and look if there's an abundance of discordance that would indicate gene flow between Drummondii and Cuspidata. So if we think about particular SNP genotypes across this phylogeny, something consistent with the phylogeny would be an ancestral allele A in Cuspidata and Pelosa, whereas these two sister lineages would have a derived SNP B, say. The two discordant topologies would be this ABBA or BABBA genotypes, where we have Remariana having the ancestral allele, but Drummondii and Cuspidata sharing this derived allele. So this would be your ABBA genotype, or you would have Remariana and Cuspidata sharing the derived allele. So an abundance of these ABBA genotypes or topology would indicate that there's gene flow between Drummondii and Cuspidata at a level that's high enough to perceive in the genome. And that's exactly what we found is a significant D statistics where we see an elevation of ABBA with just this Sympatric sample. What's pretty neat is that when we look at this allopatric sample, we don't see this elevated ABBA. Now, we need to repeat this a bunch more times and make sure it's consistent, but it maybe it's obvious and maybe it's encouraging that in Sympatry, we see evidence of gene flow, and in allopatry, that evidence is not that strong. That's good. So we can say that there's gene flow, and it's probably still happening, and it's probably fairly recent and of evolutionary significance. So then is hybridization costly? I mean, plants are awesome at heterosis and hybrid vigor. Unfortunately, not these guys. So another postdoc in the lab, Sevan Suni, did hundreds and hundreds of crosses within Cuspidata, within Drummondii, between Cuspidata and Drummondii, and the hybrids back to the parents. And the sum of the story is that the parents do pretty well. Yes, one or two seeds per cross is really good for these species. Whereas the hybrids do very, very poorly, and we're pretty lucky if we can get a few seeds out of tens of crosses. And so we see that there's high hybrid sterility, and this happens in both directions. Both maternal seed set is lower, and pollen viability is much lower. So yeah, there's a big cost to hybridization in these flocks. And as for actual variation and self-compatibility, which is what we want to think about here, yes. Hopefully, or we wouldn't be here today. So flocks in general has a genetic self-incompatibility mechanism, and Drummondii has that system active and working in most cases. Cuspidata has lost that self-incompatibility mechanism, so they are entirely self-compatible. Furthermore, when we look more closely within Drummondii, we see quantitative genetic variation in the degree of self-incompatibility. That is to say, only about 20% of the individuals that we looked at were entirely self-incompatible, and about 10% of the individuals that we looked at were entirely self-compatible, and all the rest of them had some degree of self-incompatibility, but not complete. So it looks like there's plenty of variation for evolution to act on and to give us something to look at in this area of Sympatry. Do we have a decrease in Sympatry as would be predicted by a mechanistic or genetic interaction between these two incompatibilities? Or do we see an increase in self-compatibility as would be predicted by this avoidance hypothesis to just stop outcrossing? So we're going to look now at if this phlox actually follows this SISC rule. And if these two mate choices show evidence of mechanistic links, and then what actually happens in Sympatry. So we go back to these crosses where we cross a ton of Drummondii to Cuspidata and look and see, do we find that this self-incompatible species, Drummondii, can actually reject cuspidata pollen more than this compatible species can reject Drummondii pollen? So if we look at the self-incompatible species, again, they can set 1 to 2 seeds when you outcross them with the same species, but with this heterospecific pollen or this pollen from cuspidata, we see about half the seed set. So indeed, it doesn't look like a complete incompatibility, but there's evidence that there is incompatibility consistent with this SISC rule. Furthermore, when you look at this self-compatible species and you cross it to the self-incompatible species, we see perfectly wonderful seed set, and so we see no interspecific incompatibility in that direction. So yes, at the species level, this incompatibility is consistent with the SISC rule. But I mentioned that there's variation within Drummondii in self-compatibility. It turns out there's also tons of variation in interspecific incompatibility as well. So again, some individuals are perfectly fine mating with cuspidata and producing hybrids, and some individuals are completely incapable of setting seed with hybrid pollen, with cuspidata pollen. And if we look at the correlation between interspecific seed set and self-seed set, we see a significant relationship. That is to say that those individuals that are self-incompatible are also interspecific incompatible. And those individuals that are self-compatible have interspecific incompatibility. So here we show actually for the first time that this SISC rule can actually apply within a species across individuals and segregate within populations. So this looks like, yes, at many levels, the SISC rule does apply and makes us ask, okay, is there other evidence for a mechanistic link between these two incompatibilities that might influence the evolution of this trait across geographic space? Oops, so that's what I just said. So we looked at all of these crosses at actually looking at the pistil to find out how well pollen bound, how well it germinated and the pollen tube grew, and then how much we can actually see fertilization of the ovules at this point for each of our different types of crosses. And what we found is that the only stage that was correlated with successful seed set is the amount of pollen grains that bound to the stigma. So that's here, where we have the stigmatic surface of flocks, and these are pollen grains, and you can actually fix the pistil and count the number of pollen grains on there. And if you look really closely, this is what it looks like. So this is a Phlox Drummondii pollen grain on a Phlox Drummondii stigma. They have these cool little papilla that then biochemically bind to the Phlox pollen. We don't exactly know how, but it happens right there. And we can see this binding happen before any pollen tube growth occurs, suggesting that there is an interaction with something on the pollen coat with this stigmatic surface. So when we look at outcross pollination, we see this with lots of pollen. When we look at self-pollination on a self-incompatible individual, maybe you'll see one here, and maybe you'll see one here. But I don't even need to show you the numbers for you to see that there's a huge difference in the amount of pollen that is going to bind. So, but we did quantify it. In hundreds of crosses, we can say that yes, indeed, you get a whole lot more outcross pollen than you do get self-pollen binding to the stigmatic surface. But what's really cool is that in these self-compatible individuals that self-seed, we actually see an increase in the amount of pollen that can bind to the stigmatic surface, indicating that there's something about this pollen binding that allows for successful fertilization, which makes sense. You need the pollen to bind in order for the pollen tube to grow and therefore to fertilize the sperm to fertilize the egg. What's also really neat is that we find that this same mechanism correlates with interspecific pollination success. So those individuals that are self-incompatible and have interspecific incompatibility also have much lower pollen binding than those individuals that have high compatibility. So at this stage, it looks like we have a strong correlation between interspecific pollen binding success, self-pollen binding success, and seed set, suggesting that these are the same mechanisms that are causing these incompatibilities at very different levels of reproduction. So, how are they distributed across geographic space? As predicted by this mechanistic interaction, do we actually see less compatibility in sympatry than in allopatry? Or do we see more compatibility and sympatry because these plants are just trying to avoid any interaction with hybrid pollen? So we looked across 12 populations in allopatry and 9 populations in sympatry. And I'm going to show you here the successful pollination. So with the mechanistic interaction, we expect lower seed set or more incompatibility and sympatry. And that's exactly what we find. So we see that there are more self-incompatible plants in the sympatric region and fewer in the allopatric region. And we see the same pattern for interspecific incompatibility, where in sympatry, although they still can set seed, they set significantly fewer seeds and have more incompatibility in that sympatric region than in the allopatric region. And so we believe that this pattern of correlations between incompatibilities and then across geographic space suggests that indeed there is this mechanistic interaction between these two types of mate choice, self-incompatibility and interspecific incompatibility, and that that correlation has actually constrained the evolution of self-compatibility across the range of flocks. So the scenario that we're envisioning is that this species, this purple and green area here, the species is self-incompatible. There's then self-compatible mutations that occur that may be under selection for a variety of regions for reasons for reproductive assurance. But as soon as those mutations migrate into this region of sympatry, the fact that they also cause interspecific compatibility generates selection against them through reinforcing selection because it causes interspecific incompatibility. And therefore, we get this constraint on self-compatibility in this region of sympatry. So in summary, we have a species that shows the SISC rule, this correlation between incompatibilities, both between species and within a species across individuals, and that they seem to be incompatibility seems to be caused at the same point in pollination, at the same mechanistic level. And across geographic space, it looks like this correlation or this mechanistic interaction is actually influencing the evolution of mate choice. So I would argue that we all know choosing the right choice is important, choosing the right mate is important, but there's so many different types of mate choices and they can actually interact with each other, sometimes selectively over space and sometimes actually mechanistically, like we see in this pollen pistil interaction. Such that the evolution of one type of mate choice may be actually controlled by selection on a different type of mate choice and just be evolving because of this correlation. So with that, special thanks to Federico, who did most of these crosses, as well as Matt, who's a tech in the lab, who did the other half of these crosses, and everyone else in the lab for all of their support. And now we can drink wine, or you can ask questions. The choice is yours.